This is the Popmatic Podcast for December 2nd, 2015. The best books of the year! Woo! 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 This is the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are...
Amanda.
Bale.
Mike. Jeremy.
It's what you've been waiting for all year long. Our best books episode. The best books of the year. At least the ones we got from the library this year. It's mostly going to be new things, but we're humans. Sometimes we check out old stuff, too. Not just what's new on Publishers Weekly. Who says magazines are dead? Those issues of Publishers Weekly are just blazing off the shelf.
Blazing. They're blazing.
Got a paper cut.
Best books of the year. Get pumped. All right, podcast listeners, just like... last year, we're going to do our top three. We're all going to give our number three. Then we're all going to give our number two. No jokes. Then we're all going to give our number one.
I'm doing it in no particular order. That's how I wrote it.
I think that's reasonable.
As has been noted in previous podcasts, Bill marches to the beat of a different drummer.
Yes.
Number three.
Amanda.
Yes, Brian.
Lukewarm open. Number three.
Number three.
Number three.
Okay, so this is probably my favorite podcast because I don't watch movies, so books are my thing. So these books that I have chosen might not be my super best, never wanted to end, slept with them under my pillow for 2 weeks books that I read this year, but they're the ones that stuck with me and made me want to keep reading more and more by the same author. So my number three pick is The Last 100 Years Trilogy by Jane Smiley. This features the book Some Luck, Early Warning, and Golden Age. Now, these are the only books I picked that were actually released in 2015. Some Luck technically came out back in October of 2014, blah, blah, blah. That's close enough to count. So Smiley set out to write an epic tale of the Langdon family who immigrated to America and began life on a small farm in Denby, Iowa at the turn of the 20th century. We first meet the family in 1920. So she goes from 1920, looks into the future all the way to the year 2020. And like most Midwestern immigrants of the late 19th and early 20th century, the Langdons are predominantly German, poor, but very opinionated, which sounds quite a bit like my family. I'm from rural Indiana. My family is German, and my grandfather was a farmer. Even some of the names are familiar to me, which I think I mentioned the first time I talked about Some Luck on the podcast a couple months ago. Now that I've finished all 1,235 pages of this trilogy, there's a few more differences as the story progressed. My favorite part of the books is that each chapter is a year, so the author doesn't get overly bogged down in, say, 1974. She picks a couple family members, maybe one or two events that focus on, you know, and focuses on that for the year as opposed to digging really deep into each year. Secondly, I like how she weaves the family into major historical events like the Vietnam War, 9/11, Hurricane Sandy. Sometimes they were big, life-changing moments, and other times they were just kind of passing events. And a couple times I kind of found myself thinking, oh yeah, I remember that. I was in high school when that happened. So that was kind of fun. I didn't like all of the characters, but as I was reading, I just kind of kept shaking my head. Because without matching all of the details 100%, this totally could have been my family. And I think I liked it so much because I identified with it. I've been meaning to read her for a while, and I'm glad I finally picked her up her books. And at some point, I'm going to have to go out and check her Pulitzer Prize winner, which is called 1,000 Acres, and see how that one goes. Recently, she did come to one of our Salon at 6:15 events to promote these books. Woo! I didn't get to go, so I'm looking forward to seeing if our web team will post the podcast from that event. So stay tuned for that. That was the Last 100 Years Trilogy by Jane Smiley. Bill?
Well, number three, Missoula, Rape, and the Justice System in a College Town by John Krakauer. I talked about this book earlier this year, and the book still sticks with me. In brief, the book deals with a college town, Missoula, Montana, in which between January 2008 to May 2012, the Department of Justice investigated 350 sexual assaults reported to the Missoula Police Department and how they were not handled properly. And that's an understatement, I should say. The book is totally engrossing. And by the end, if you're not outraged by the injustice of the situation, something is wrong with you. Once again, Missoula, Rape, and the Justice System in a College Town by John Krakauer.
Mike? I love that that's one of your favorite books, because the first time when Brian mentioned it, he's like, no one's ever going to talk about this on the podcast.
Yeah.
I admire your conciseness. I just finished Missoula. John Krakauer is a really, really great author. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's really hard to be a great nonfiction author, especially if you're coming from a journalistic background. Mm-hmm. But the way he structures his books are just really good. And what I liked best about that book is he presents three cases, and they're like different aspects of the way you could handle a rape trial. But then at the end, he saves what the Department of Justice report actually said, like for the very end of the book. And then he's like, well, here's, and then he gives these three cases to show all these different aspects. And then at the end, he's like, and then here's all this other stuff. And it's like, it just hits you like a ton of bricks. The way he structured that short little book was masterful. I admire his skills. I'm sorry for the interjection. Mike.
Well, and now for a complete 180, 360, 780 turn. Light reading for the bathroom or between weightier novels, I like to call in-betweeners. You know, comic books, one-volume encyclopedias, art books, etc., etc. And for number three, I'd like to put forth my favorite in-betweener that I read this year, God Hates Astronauts, Volume 1, The Head That Wouldn't Die. Oh, boy. The tale of a hapless squad of semi-do-gooders employed by NASA to prevent farmers from building rockets into space was a bizarre trip that I wished would never end. It's as if Adult Swim made The Avengers, as penned by the guy who made House. Watch out for the Reginald Bell Johnson look-alike with gorilla arms named Gnarled Winslow.
Is it Ryan?
Ryan Brown.
Ryan Brown. I was thinking of Ryan North.
We got Jeremy.
Speaking of North.
You looked at me? I don't know what that means.
No, yeah, I'm just looking around. Because none of you know that North.
Some sort of feng shui.
North is an album by the author of my third favorite book of the year, Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink by Elvis Costello. I talked about this in the print cast. I've mentioned it maybe. I've talked about Elvis before. His music is really the only music I consistently care about, so I was very excited about when his memoir was announced. I've read a few other books about him. I read one that was from the 90s that I think was from written by a British journalist, and like the second to last line in the book was some sort of like smart aleck quote from Elvis, and then the last line in the book was, "Oh, Mr. Costello, really?" And so... not really a strong body of work about his body of work. So yeah, I was very excited to see his side of the story. And it is a good book. It is also a frustrating book, and I think that's part of why I like it, because it sort of is very much like his career, and that like he's doing this, and then like, oh, there's a string quartet. Okay, fair enough. Oh, you're singing with the Mingus Big Band. Fair enough. But how about like some songs that we know and come to expect from you, and it's like all, kind of always doing the unexpected thing and then doing the expected thing and whatever. In the book, he talks a lot about his father's career. His father was a singer with the Joe Loss Orchestra in England. They were a radio big band orchestra kind of, and then they did a lot of pop music covers basically to sort of keep up with the times. And this is kind of a really good device that he uses in the book, because his father's career sort of is a twisted sort of mirror image of his own career. His father was really successful but not famous. He's kind of a philandering ladies' man, and he's kind of remembered more for something silly, which was like a lemonade commercial that he sang on, which was mentioned in his obituary, rather than his true talents. And this is sort of a fate that Elvis has avoided mostly in the eyes of most people. However, in some people's eyes, he is just remembered as, you know, the guy with glasses who sang Allison, or the guy with glasses who used racial epithets against people in a hotel in Columbus, Ohio. Or he's a great musician who has a long and complex life and career, and it's captured in this book. Brian?
Thanks, Jeremy. That was really good. I'd like that you stick to your Elvis Costello guns. That's admirable.
I do. Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting here in my hands, so I don't get in trouble.
You can take them from my cold, dead hands.
No. What is not admirable was that as podcast host, I actually probably talked longer than Bill did about the book that he talked about after I complimented him on his conciseness.
I like these in episodes.
I noticed that too. But I thought I'd be polite.
In episode corrections.
Not.
You were adding. You were not subtracting.
Yeah.
I'm just I'm just going to go long now. Again, I'm terrible.
I'm in
person.
On long this week.
This is a conversation.
I'm glad I did not write much for Tickle My Fancy, because...
My number three, the Barrett Brown Review of Arts and Letters and Prison by Barrett Brown.
Wow.
Barrett Brown is a controversial figure. He was sentenced to 63 months in federal prison for crimes of accessory after the fact, obstruction of justice, and threatening a federal officer. The accessory after the fact came about when he linked in a chat room to an email trove that was illegally obtained by hackers. Some journalists said that he was railroaded, that other journalists and a lot of other people were linking to the same email trove all over the internet, and that the feds were just picking on him. A lot of other people, including the federal government, felt otherwise. But regardless about the details of his case, he is a fearless and hilarious writer. Upon his sentence, he wrote, quote, "The U.S. government decided today that because I did such a good job at investigating the cyber industrial complex, they're now going to send me to investigate the prison industrial complex," unquote. So he started writing articles from prison under the name The Barrett Brown Review of Arts and Letters in Prison, first in D Magazine, which is a Dallas magazine. D stands for Dallas. But then most recently in the website The Intercept. But he's been published these articles in other places too, like Vice. I'll put a link that lists all the places where all the articles under this heading have been published. And actually, he isn't doing much investigative journalism from prison, because that would just result of him getting thrown in solitary confinement, which is not solitary if you read the letters, because the prison he is in is so overcrowded that if you get thrown in solitary, you actually share the cell with another person. But
America!
But relating to the concerns on our show, what he does often do is write hilarious, scathing book reviews of the books that people send him to read. He is lose your... funny. I'll beep that. He shreds everything from Jonathan Franzen to Nora Roberts and even the memoirs of Henry Kissinger, which is hilarious because he's in prison. He actually has the time to read the entire memoirs of Henry Kissinger, which are this huge multi-thousands of pages tome.
That Jonathan Franzen one was really funny.
If anyone can be compared to Hunter S. Thompson, it is Barrett Brown, a for real outlaw journalist writing letters from prison. Don't miss it.
Number two.
Okay, moving on to the fabulous number two. My pick is kind of more an author than just a book, but so I'm going to talk about J. Martin Troost, specifically, I guess, for his The Sex Lives of Cannibals, but I'm also going to mention his other books. So I think Mike and I are actually going to start the J. Martin Troost Book Club. So
I'll be treasurer.
Dang it, I wanted that job. So during one of our roving summer podcasts, Mike had mentioned that he listened to the recording of Troost's first book, The Sex Lives of Cannibals. And I, too, read this book and had enjoyed it. The library only has it on Hoopla right now, but it's definitely worth the listen, or if you want, I can try to get you a copy through interlibrary loan. Troost is funny and self-deprecating, and it's kind of hard to have humor about living on an atoll in the South Pacific, where the reef and the bathrooms are kind of the same thing. But Troost somehow manages to pull it off. Mike also mentioned that Troost had written several other books, so since the library has all of them in print and some in audio, I thought I would take a read. I liked the other three, but maybe not quite as much as the first one. Getting Stoned with Savages is the second one. It's very similar to the first one, except now we've moved to Vanuatu and Fiji. His third book is a book called Lost in China. It kind of freaked me out a little bit because he had to eat live squid.
Yeah.
And again, you know, potty humor comes up. Little kids pee on the street everywhere over there. So while the book was interesting, I think I'll be postponing any plans I have to visit China. Also, the air pollution sounds like a nightmare, so me and my wimpy little girl lungs are just going to, you know, stay here and breathe normally. Thank you.
There's a State Department warning, too, for U.S. travelers abroad.
Yeah. I mean, it just sounded like everywhere he went was just like the sky was, like, brown.
Thank PSA, Jeremy.
So yeah. So anyway, so then after China, Troost kind of got himself into a little bit of trouble with alcohol, and I can't say that I'm shocked. And he, you know, he would admit this. He actually admitted it on the book jacket of his last book. When you write a book called Getting Stoned with Savages, you might have a problem with certain substances.
Oh, like ayahuasca?
Yeah, so the fourth book he wrote is called Headhunters on My Doorstep. It's from 2013, and it's kind of a travelogue. Back in his friendly South Pacific, it kind of catalogs his travels a la Robert Louis Stevenson. Kind of in parallel with his recovery after a stint in rehab. It's a little cliche, writers and drugs and booze, who hasn't been there? But Troost's natural snarkiness does still liven up the writing. He's still funny. I'm a little disappointed that he hasn't written anything lately. He keeps mentioning how much he likes weather, so I'm really hoping that his next book is going to be on storm chasing.
Oh, man, that's like right up your alley.
I know, right?
Book about storms.
So like the last couple summers have been really slow tornado-wise, so maybe he's just out gathering information. Hint, hint, Martin and Troost, hint, hint.
Twister 2.
There you go, the search for more money.
The new batch.
All right, Mr. Bill.
My number two is, well, it just recently came out. It's The Crossing by Michael Connelly. It's a Cracker Jack murder mystery featuring retired detective Harry Bosch, who has teamed with the Lincoln lawyer Mickey Holler to see who might have actually brutally murdered a woman. It's just a good mystery. It's a pure L.A. novel, and it's kind of interesting. Michael Connelly really has a feel for this type of material since he was a crime reporter in Los Angeles for a long time. So I highly recommend The Crossing by Michael Connelly. Mike?
I gotta read more than just The Lincoln Lawyer one of these days. I had the first Harry Bosch book, but I haven't read it. Anyway, my favorite nonfiction book of the year, which I keep putting in like the Popmatic scheduling thing and keep shaking around, but finally gonna talk about it this time.
Yay!
Was How Music Got Free by Stephen Witt. Backstory. So I went earlier this year to get the inside of my car washed because it'd never been done, and there's certain stains that can never get out. And the only...
Be afraid, listeners. Be afraid.
Don't ask about the previous tenants in my house. And the only entertainment that I brought was this book. And I read more than half of it in one sitting, and I was totally riveted. It was like 2 hours later, my eyes were so stinging. And then it's like, oh, your car's ready. Well, but I'm only halfway through. This is pretty rare for me in nonfiction, because, you know, nonfiction writing style is not paramount, let's put it that way. The book tells the story of the creation of the MP3, the rise of music piracy, and the fall of the music industry through the eyes of key players from all fields. The head of the German music consortium that created the MP3, which is really an abusing dude who created, you know, him and his team created the MP3 to make money.
There's German efficiency for you.
Yeah, but they couldn't sell their programming, so they put it up as freeware. Uh-oh. And then another person that is profiled as one of the most prolific music uploaders of the late 90s to mid-2000s, who worked at Universal Music Group's CD manufacturing facility and would just kind of like borrow a CD every day or three and then upload them sometimes months in advance of the official release date, which would anger the corporate masters, but they didn't find out for quite a while. And the head of the Universal Music Group, who's this like old time, like, you know, started the music industry in like the 70s and worked his way up to becoming like, you know, he would make like a percentage of what the corporation would make all the time. Like, you know, he'd make a flat, you know, whatever, 10% of what the company made. So he made millions of dollars while artists were starving. Yeah.
Stupid artists.
Yeah. Fools trying to create art. Which also chimes in occasionally with how, with how he discovered music through this time. And since he's a year older than me, it eerily parallels my own forms of musical discovery from, you know, he found MP3s in college. I found them in high school. My friends are like, hey, Mike, you can download music free. And I'm like, tell me more. To nowadays, to where, like, he exclusively streams music, as do I, you know, through YouTube or Spotify. And the idea of buying music is just weird, unless, like, it's unavailable on streaming platforms. And then, which, you know, as of right now, it's usually music that's, you know, that Japanese klezmer band of the Wall Street Journal profile a couple weeks ago. And I was like, this is amazing. I listened to their one CD that's available in America. And it's like, oh, I have to buy another nine. Oh, they're like $30 a piece.
I paid 92 cents for the first Led Zeppelin album the other day.
Do your maker.
It was scratch up.
I just started reading that book, too, and I've enjoyed it. So I'm only about a third of the way through it. But
yeah. Wow.
I mean, because I worked in the business, too, when it was doing all that stuff. And so I'm like,
so I guess you've got a much different perspective than I do.
Yeah, because I never did it. I never did it when I was in college, but my roommate was like, anything on Napster she downloaded, because we had the Ethernet connection, and so that was just like, whee!
Yeah, it was great.
It's
fast! I would connect to the college networks, and they'd have, like, stuff uploaded by, like,
yeah,
other people in my dorm.
Yeah, she'd have, like, 15 versions of one song, and, like,
yeah,
like, two of them would work all the way through. And,
golden era.
I did not own a computer of my own until 2005.
Unless you're from Kentucky, it's okay.
Yeah, what's it like to be a caveman in today's America?
I can't download this song on my abacus made out of
coal. I got my calculator right here.
I went to school on a horse.
What time is it? The clouds are covering the sun.
My brother's my sister.
Sit low, hanging fruit.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt the hillbilly joke fest, but I feel morally obligated to say that there are actually free formats besides the MP3 that that German company Reitzhold does still own the rights to.
Yes.
And to use the MP3, you have to buy the rights from them. But there are lots of other audio formats that are totally free that would make more sense for the entire world to use, especially government institutions, big libraries.
Thanks, Neil Young.
But anyway, Mike, you're number Jeremy, you're number two.
Well, whoever you are.
It's the Kono format, my Neil Young.
It's the bearded guy corner. You know? I like Elvis Costello.
We've already. My number two book is A Guide to Beard Oil by your mama. My number two book is a comic book called Black Rat by Cole Klosser. Klosser's previous book, 2013's Little Tommy Lost, was a Little Orphan Annie riff, which sort of stayed so close to its source material that it even sort of recreated the aesthetic experience of old newspaper clippings that sort of looked like it was assembled from cutout newspapers of different quality, and like some were sort of peeling and yellowing and stuff. And that lost time feeling sort of remains in this book, Black Rat, although there is decidedly, the narrative is decidedly not there or is less straightforward. This is sort of an art comic slash illuminated manuscript slash funny animal pastiche, whose meaning I can't even begin to decipher. It's just sort of an experience. There's a little black rat in each vignette. There's a cube, and then there's that kind of keeps recurring and flattening and changing shapes, and there's lots of traveling between different levels of reality. And the only thing I didn't like about the book, which you may not care about, assuming you're cool with the whole art over narrative thing, is that there's a picture of the author in the back of the book, and it ruin my experience, but the previous book and this book both have, like I said, this lost time, out of time feeling. And so I sort of had created this image of him as this, like, Robert Johnson kind of comic book maker guy. And he's not. He's a handsome young man with a beard who has a tattoo on his chest. That was a little, that took me out of my own romance and put me into someone else's. So, but
wow, I didn't expect half the book review to be like, you're disappointed by how the author looks. But okay, sure.
Hand gestures.
Finger cramp.
All right.
But it's a pretty great book.
You know, sometimes it's better, like for me at this point in my book journey, I don't want to know anything about the author.
Well, I think
increasingly finding that the more you find out about an artist, the less I want to know about them.
The book has this, like, it's not a mystery, but there is a mystery about, like, what is going on in this thing? And to sort of attach a human face to it, sort of demystify. You don't see the face of the monks who drew all these crazy illuminated manuscripts or whatever, you know what I mean?
That's good, because I bet they were ugly.
They're probably super terrible teeth.
No teeth.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
it's hard to take photographs in the 1400s.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a difficult, you'd still be posing now. But that's what it is. It sort of took me out of the sort of like weird art experience of it. And it's like, oh yeah, this is actually, I know it's made by a human, but I sort of prefer like the sort of like it's handed down from above now, feeling that's in it.
I feel your pain about being disappointed that the author of one of your favorite books turned out to be a hipster D-bag. But I can proudly say that I don't really know anything about the author of my number two book of the year. That would be
Masterful Segue.
Cinema of the Present by Lisa Robertson. I first talked about this book back in our April 29th, 2015 episode. That was our poetry episode, and dang it, this is a book of poetry.
It made your top three list. Wow.
The whole book is just one long poem. There would be one line and then a double space and then an italicized line. Sometimes individual lines repeat, and sometimes there are variations on lines that came before. It kind of has the visual effect of a flickering film strip. It's written in the first person. She's sort of like talking at her lover and her friend. And I don't know, maybe just because the author of the book is named Lisa Robertson, I kind of imagine that it's a female talking to her male lover or friend. And it's just kind of talking about, well, you said this and you did that and you have all these theories about this. And maybe it's just because when it was published, but I just, or the subject matter, but I couldn't help but to think she's subtly critiquing him about having all these theories or things to say about events happening in the world, in particular Occupy Wall Street and the Arab Spring, but not actually doing anything about it. So I felt like, you know, you have all these theories and stuff, but you don't really engage. But then also I think that all is also happening in their sex life or lack thereof. I think the narrator is subtly criticizing her lover about you have all these theories about sex, but you're not really delivering. Ooh. And besides being about political events and interpersonal events, it's also about just how we perceive the present. You know, the title of the poem is The Cinema of the Present, and how we navigate consciousness when things are happening in the outside world. At least that's how I read it. It is undeniably in the modernist tradition, and therefore it can be somewhat obtuse in regards to its meaning, and I am really, really okay with that. If I had to name a poet from the canon that I love, I would probably be quick to name Wallace Stevens. And Wallace Stevens' poetry is lyrically very beautiful, but the exact meaning is very fuzzy. The cinema of the present is the same. You may remember the lines I quoted on our poetry episode. What if your only witness were an animal against which you perceive a joyous unfounding? I'm in debt to your radiant obscenity. I have no idea what that means, but I love it. I actually used these lines in an art project here at the library. How could this book not be on my year-end list? And the thumbnail of the cover looked really good when I posted the podcast episode to the library's blog. So really, what else matters? My number two, Cinema of the Present by Lisa Robinson.
Number one.
All right, number one.
We're ready.
Number one, the best of the best, the cream of the crop. We've taken all the poison away, and all that's left is the tofu.
I'm excited.
Is that how tofu is made?
Cool. Yeah.
Wow.
I think so.
Yeah.
Amanda.
Corrections.
So my tofu this year, actually, Bill kind of stole my thunder a little bit, because my favorite series that I found this year would have to be the Lincoln Lawyer series by Michael Connelly. I actually read the first one after Crystal's Killer Thriller book club read it, and she and Mike had mentioned it on the podcast. Mm. So Mickey Haller is a defense attorney in Los Angeles County, and I've also enjoyed several of Connelly's books featuring him, as well as Detective Harry Bosch. Bosch has his own series that actually started first in 1992. I haven't gotten to go back and read that one yet. The Lincoln Lawyer series first published in 2005, so there's a little bit of a discrepancy there. Eventually, the series kind of intertwine, and the characters make crossovers, and as Bill mentioned, the latest book in both series is called The Crossing, and it just came out November 3rd, so it hasn't been out very long. But I haven't gotten that far yet, so I can't count it as a new book. I'm only in number four, The Reversal. It's at that really good part where I really kind of wish I was there listening to it instead of here talking about it, but I want to see what happens. But I do like that he's merging them together because the characters work really well as a team. I think that I want to go back and read Bosch because I like his character almost as much as I like Mickey Haller. Bosch is a little more grouchy, but he's really sharp and is a good cop. And Connelly also wrote a nonfiction book called Crime Beat that Bill had mentioned. He was a crime reporter before he became a novelist, and this book kind of consolidates some of that, his earlier work as well. Connelly's a good suspense writer. He knows how to build a case, but he also knows how to write a believable whodunit they're not super predictable, which I appreciate. I figured out a couple things here or there, but there was always a couple of twists I didn't catch. We have these in print and audio, and I've kind of been switching back and forth depending on what was available at the time. And I have to admit that the audiobooks are almost kind of like watching an episode of Law & Order or NCIS, except they take a little longer. They are highly readable and highly recommended. Bill?
My numero uno is Doing Time, Notes from the Underground by Rob Thomas. It's a YA book, and Rob Thomas is the creator of Veronica Mars, and he developed iZombie for television. But like I said before, he was a TV writer. He wrote young adult books. And over the summer, I discovered Doing Time, Notes from the Underground. It's a collection of 10 short stories in which students have to fulfill 200 hours of community service to graduate. Each student has his story, and each story ends with an O. Henry-type twist ending. Good stuff. I was really surprised how much I liked it. Each story is unique, and you just can't go to the library. You have to put this on hold because it's in the catacombs of the library in the annex, but it's well worth doing that, and so it was just one of the neat discoveries of the year.
Is it kind of like Veronica Mars, or is it?
No, it's nothing like that. It's just each story of these kids doing community service, and like I said, it's kind of surprising where it takes you.
Because I like Rob Thomas. I haven't read that one.
All right, Mike.
See, I always get Rob Thomas of Veronica Mars fame confused with Rob Thomas of Matchbox 20 fame.
Yeah. Yeah. Veronica Mars, different Rob guy. Thomas is way cooler.
You know, like, a few episodes I've seen of I, Zombie way better than that song you did with Santana.
Give me I, Zombie. Make it real.
And now, my favorite fiction book of 2015. I pulled an Amanda and read this book specifically for this very podcast last week, and I liked it so much, I'll put it in number one. Slate House by David Mitchell. Ah. AKA, I mentioned this like 3 weeks ago. Slade House is about a house that appears in a narrow alleyway once on October 30th every 9 years. And each part of the book details the events in the house from October 30th, 1979 to October 30th, 2015. Ooh. Whoever enters this dread house has a chance to never leave. Ooh. Now that I've read it, I can say the stuff I liked about it, like how it tied into...
Okay, wait, so I'm sorry. So before you hadn't read it yet, but you were looking forward to it, and now you've actually read it. Okay, sorry, I was just clarifying.
Yeah, there you go.
I thought you... I'm like, he already talked about that.
No, I hadn't actually read it. I just read the back of the book copy. You know, I was like, this sounds cool.
So you pulled a Brian before, and now you pulled a me and finished it.
Yeah,
so, I'm with it, okay.
And now I'm talking about Jeremy, where I'm just going to go off on tangents.
Okay, cool. I'm in there. I'm catching up.
Ooh, a haunted house. Oh, how original. Where is it? In the Midwest?
It's in London.
Jesus.
Oh, it's in London?
Oh, Victorian! Oh, how spooky. I hope the Ripper's been captured, Governor.
That was worth the whole podcast right there.
I should have let Bill off the chain and not Jeremy. Then he just would have glowered at me for about
revenge 5 minutes. Is a dish best served loud.
You can only kick a dog so many times.
Yeah,
right.
I guess.
You know. That's right.
I guess I'll listen to whatever good Elvis Costello song is and
Little T Traumas, my friend.
It won't take very long.
Little
T Traumas.
I will tramp the dirt down.
Jeremy.
Oh, wait.
I cut him.
That was his first paragraph.
I had to clarify. Sorry.
I can't believe he's only got through one paragraph.
I didn't even get into a Jeremy-style bloviation. You know, I was going to say stuff I liked about it, that it ties in with the bow clocks and unfortunately a lot of spoiler-tastic ways that I can't talk about it right now. I also liked that as the house gradually over time becomes like an urban legend around London ghost hunters and such try to track it down and figure out its secrets after, you know, it's like, well, this has been 9 years, surely something's going to happen. Ah! You know, like in one mass appearance in the 1990s, a group of ghost hunting students become known as the X-Files 6 after they disappear, which amused me. In Cloud Atlas, Mitchell used repetition/foreknowledge and story structure in a really interesting way to, like, you know, instill, like, dread or suspense in, like, the other half of each part. And then this, like, he uses a similar kind of, like, repetition in each segment, but this time to instill terror. For each section, you know, not every section begins and ends the same way. I expect him to go one way, and, oh, he twists another way that I didn't expect, which I really liked, you know. Good stuff. What have you got, Elvis?
That sounds really cool.
Yeah.
My favorite book of the year is the audio version of the Elvis Costello.
If you did, I would leave.
No, I did finish the book and then immediately started listening to the audio version.
Well, that's
Does
he read it?
He reads it.
That's cool.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. It's
I like
cool.
when the author reads it.
Yeah, me too.
What if you don't like his voice, though? All the people that don't like
his voice. No, I'm not going to listen to it. I'm just saying, cool for you.
His voice is different than his singing voice, but
he tricked us into talking about Elvis Costello anyway. That was brilliant. I like that.
I'm kind of a brilliant guy.
Can we have a Bloister Cult podcast?
We did.
my favorite book of the year was a book that was really difficult for me, but I'm glad that I stuck with it and continued reading it. It's called The Country of Ice Cream Star by Sandra Newman. This book takes place 80 years after a plague has wiped out all the adults and all the white people in America, possibly the world, but we don't exactly know. And it's written in a dialect that sort of has developed over this time period, and it's a patois mixed together of like under 20-year-old people's slang, and there's African-American slang. There is sort of like the way a child mishears a word And then continues to say that word. Like my son says, Marote control.
Or like instead, me talking on any week's podcast.
Brian speaking. Yeah. So in the book, like a word like notebook becomes no book, and the United States becomes the United States, which is also like kind of like a metaphorical way of looking at the United States after it's been wiped
out. That's cool. You should just change it to that.
Yeah, I think it's kind of rad.
That's
where I
live in the United States.
So, and this book, it also, the whole time I read it, it kept making me think of, I had a paperback copy of A Clockwork Orange that my uncle gave me, and in the back there was a glossary that had like what every word meant. So like when I tried to read it when I was in seventh grade, I was like, forget this. But even though there was a glossary, I finally read it and was like, oh, this is handy. But after a while, you sort of learn that language, even if you don't know the exact word that they're using, you get the context from it. So it's like it is like reading another language. And that was what I found with this book. It was like really immersive. And, you know, once you kind of got into the rhythm of it, like it was really amazing feat too, because it's like almost 700 pages or something. But it's really for me, it was really best enjoyed in long chunks. Now, Sandra Newman is a white woman. And so there's plenty to be said about like a white person writing a book that's populated basically exclusively by people of color. But race, as we know it, doesn't exactly exist in this book, if it exists in the real world. Anyway, it's a social construct, right? Dan Harmon. So anyway, that's not that part of it. I didn't explore that with myself as I was reading it so much. But there is something to be explored there. But I also think that's sort of a testament to the world that the author has built. And also there's a lot of death and heartache in this, because every person in the book every person is going to die like around age 20. So children are having babies, they're having to care for little children. It's like no one really gets a chance to be a child. And so that can be very overwhelming. But it never feels bleak. Because children are the main focus of it, and they're I think no one ever gets old enough in the book to lose hope, and so that's sort of that sort of gave me hope in it instead of it being a major downer. So check it out, Brian.
You sure that wasn't my best book of the year?
I'm pretty sure.
In other bizarro world flip-flops, my number one book of the year is by an author that's usually considered a science fiction author. Mike's number one book of the year was by an author that's usually considered to be a literary author. Bizarro world. My number one, my favorite book of the year, The Peripheral by William Gibson. Now, of course, this isn't actually my real number one. My real number one is The Devil Is Here in These Hills, West Virginia Coal Miners and Their Battle for Freedom by James R. Green. It made me cry at the DMV, but I know...
We've all done that.
Are you sure that's what made you cry?
I thought my weird personal story was neat.
Okay. I know that no one cares about that, and that makes me cry when I'm alone in the recording booth after everyone leaves. I just... My number one book is The Peripheral by William Gibson. I am giving into peer pressure somewhat and intentionally talking about a genre novel. This is a pop culture podcast, supposedly.
Depends on the day.
I could have done an old nonfiction one, but then I realized that no one would care about these but me.
Yes. Wikipedia says that The Peripheral is a science fiction mystery thriller novel. I will also make an argument that it is a horror novel. Mm-hmm. Now, this book actually came out in late 2014, but I didn't read it until early 2015.
It totally counts.
And I've been waiting to talk about it all year.
Whoa.
So this is an entire year's worth of delayed gratification. Here it comes.
Ooh, hijack the podcast.
Uh-oh.
The plot's really complicated. I hope you guys can follow this. The Peripheral starts in a recognizable near future.
Uh-oh.
Right? Okay. There's this family and friends, this group of family and friends, all working class military veterans. They're just trying to get by in a world where the only legal business is a totalitarian version of Walmart.
Oh, my gosh.
Mean Walmart?
Oh, man.
Hi-ho.
Heavy-handed.
The nightmare?
Rollback special on pain.
So one of these vets named Burton, he gets a job doing surveillance in a video game, right? Because it's the near future, you might get a job doing that in a video game, especially if you were an ex-soldier. He gets bored and asks his sister, Flynn, to do the video game surveillance for him. While she is doing this, she witnesses a murder.
Dun, dun, dun.
Spoiler! It's not really a video game. It's the future, or at least some version of the future, and it was a real-life murder. But it's not Burton and Flynn's future. They exist in a timeline created by a quantum computer controlled by someone else in the future where the murder took place.
I'm 100% buying this book.
Yeah. Maybe as soon as you leave this room.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, if my phone was with me, it would be on my Amazon wish list.
Yes. Their entire universe is someone else's SimCity or Dwarf Fortress, if you will.
1,000,000%.
Dwarf Fortress.
Okay. Okay. Must buy book. Dwarves.
Oh, it's like World on a Wire, but modern.
You want plausible deniability? Hire someone from an imaginary universe that you're running inside a quantum computer. Now, in the timeline where the quantum computer is that created Flynn and Burton, there are those trying to cover up the murder, but there are also those who are trying to solve the murder. So to eliminate the only witnesses to the murder, the adversaries from the future start altering the simulated timeline that Burton and Flynn live in. Are you following me? That's one subplot, right?
You really need to check out a movie called World on a Wire. We don't have it. But it sounds a lot like this, but it's from 40 years ago from Germany. Anyway.
Yes, okay. Yes. Flynn and Burton's world is recognizably like our own, but the future timeline, the future world, is not recognizable at all. It's equal parts heaven, equal parts hell. Ooh. It's this surreal techno dream world. Whoa. It has diverged drastically from other timelines because of an event called the jackpot. And one of the great teases of the book is the ramp up and then reveal of what the jackpot is, or should I say was. The jackpot is the thing that makes this world go into this surreal shift. And then, of course, this future world is kind of like some sort of weird, like, cyber, like, Hieronymus Bosch kind of thing. And it's almost horror. The atmosphere is so tense, right? All our fears about technology have gone as worse as they can go. It's also this is kind of like the logical extension, I think, of Gibson's previous trilogy, the Blue Ant trilogy, which Gibson himself said was all surface, just style, but not a lot of plot. But here, you get all that spooky world that Gibson creates, that you know, where he kind of teases out our fears about the future, but actually you get fleshed out characters and a real full, rich story, at least for a genre novel. Snob card!
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
I'm insecure. I have to drop snob cards all over the place. What do you want from me?
You dropped it on yourself.
Yeah.
You have a house of snob cards.
I'm surprised I've entered a parallel universe where I really, really want to read Brian's book.
I want to read Slate House, too. We get to know Flynn and Burton's family and friends, and in that sci-fi way, we get a critique of our society by contrasting their world with the quantum computer future. Like I said, it kind of feels like Gibson's last three books were written over the course of a decade, which is the warm-up to this one. And he finally delivered his best book in a long time. It will scare you. It will put a new wrinkle on your brain. And it has a bunch of X-Men crap about how the plot gets resolved that I didn't even talk about, so I don't care about that kind of thing. But everyone else in the room would probably love it.
Is it literally X-Men crap, or are you referring to the plot devices as X-Men-like?
I believe he's referring to the plot devices as X-Men.
You know, there's this stupid way of like, well, how do you get people from the quantum computer world into the future world, right?
I don't,
who cares,
No,
right?
I think that's a brilliant...
Right? I would be totally into this plot.
I love that as a descriptor.
My favorite book of the sort of this year, The Peripheral by William Gibson. Amazing.
Can I have a weird podcast fact?
Yes.
So you mentioned the artist Hieronymus Bosch.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the Connolly books, that's who Harry Bosch is named after. That's his real name.
Well, we're all like tied together.
Bring it home.
Yeah. Weird pop-matic podcast fact.
Weird.
So.
Wait, does anybody have any corrections? Sky mostly have bloviations.
Well,
I would love to have corrections, but...
Well, I would normally listen to the episode to see what I got wrong, but I couldn't, so...
Some jerk didn't send us the episode.
So I don't know what I got wrong. What did I get wrong?
I got nothing wrong.
Actually, you didn't do anything wrong. This is a bloviation. Yes.
All right.
You told that very touching, heartwarming story about sitting in the rocking chair while your dad played video games, reading Terry Pratchett before. Right.
Sure.
I didn't mention that because it was...
Was the second time we told that story?
Wasn't that 2 weeks?
That was a nice, heartwarming story. That might have been 2 weeks ago,
That was 2 weeks ago. Corrections!
Everything that Bill talked about...
Oh, boy.
That was on YouTube, as far as I can tell, was probably on YouTube illegally. This put me
Let's say it was in a gray legal space that was created by the current technology that has been unleashed on humanity.
I think that that's untrue.
Shut down.
Technically, I can say that I don't know the copyright status of any of those things that Bill talked about. But that did put me in an interesting position professionally.
I would argue fair use.
Ooh, a moral loophole.
And maybe for the intros to Moviedrome, which I did link to, but the entire BBC documentaries that were just uploaded by private people, I'm pretty sure that, no, that's probably where a little might be gray area.
It's like pirate radio.
Well, it's not legally available in our hemisphere, so, you know.
So we can illegally watch it on YouTube?
Yeah, it's like I said, man, we fought a war against them people.
I mean, I've been wanting
to watch... This ain't over.
I've been wanting to watch Dan Cruikshank's Adventures in Architecture, but it's unavailable here. So I've been watching it on.
I've got to have my Graham Norton.
So I kind of feel like this is just an argument, like a pro piracy argument. So I guess one of the things I have written down here is like we can't just be the Popmatic Pirate Bay podcast. You can get it on the internet.
Hey. I don't think it's not about piracy. It's about access. So access has got to come from somewhere. And if it comes from knocking down the door and then and breaking the frame, but then someone's like, hey, maybe we should put a frame back on that door, then let's build a frame. But otherwise, you got a big hole in your wall, son.
Like I said,
that makes sense.
Interesting philosophical debate. I did not link to the two complete movies that I think were probably on YouTube illegally, but you can go back to listen to that episode, get those titles, and watch those if you so desire. There is a better fair use argument for the Moviedrome intros, and I did link to those, which somebody made a nice, awesome playlist of. And I like Alex Cox. For more information about copyright, you can check out Crow Doctorow's book, Information Does Not Want to Be Free, or you also could check out the book, The Copyright Wars, Three Centuries of Transatlantic Battle by Peter Baldwin. Oh, last year, Princeton University Press. Oh, it's the best of the year show. I didn't even know. You can get these books from the library, put them on hold at our website.
Wow. I feel underprepared today.
Come on, man.
Then you can make photocopies of that and keep it for yourself.
Whoa!
Oh, Kinko's, they have signs.
This is war.
My friend was going to be Old Dirty Bastard for Halloween one year, even though he was a white man. But he didn't. I'm cutting this story off right here
because when I said you should go to the library and put it on hold, that was the cue for www.library.nashville.org.
Wu-Tang.
..
And our theme music is by...
Adam D. It's for the children.
All right. Next week... Best music of the year.
Ooh. Short episode.
Who's that on the red carpet? Is that Stephen King with a green beard?
Nora Roberts, who are you wearing?
Dennis Lehane and the corpse of Edward Bain.
Corpse. Dennis Lehane and the Corpse of Epic Babe would be like a good like book themed band to play at like AMA conferences and stuff.
Yeah, it's the opening act for the Rock Bottom Remainders.
Yeah, there you go.
But it was weird because you're talking about when we were talking about things not getting things, like when I saw people, grown people reading Harry Potter on the subway in New York, grown-ups. I used to do a bit about it. I was like, it's not, it's for children. You know, like I was livid about how many grown adults I saw reading Harry Potter. Yeah. I was mad about it. It had nothing to do with you.
No.
But I was like, what is happening to
have
this
you ever
culture?
Read them?
Never.
They're really good.
All right.
That's the thing. It's
no, I know people say that, you know, but I like I'm so deliberate about what I read. I don't read for entertainment. If I'm going to read something, it's got to be great.